Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
What they're trying to do is to coerce the countries of the world into becoming vassals to do as they're told. And it's part of a larger scheme. And they want to create an unelected world government of, by, and for their own benefits. And unless we do something, that is going to happen. It's been going on for 60 or 70 years now, and we have done nothing about it because most people don't understand what money is or where it comes from.
That's Canada's renowned and respected veteran statesman Paul Hellyer, who was elected to office 67 years ago. He's our guest today on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Hi, I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and chair of the Public Banking Institute. Today, we're taking a look at another assortment of facts and observations about this monetary world of ours, a world, it seems, that just couldn't exist without money. And yet, money is merely a symbolic medium of exchange, relationship, and of value. It's meaningless all by itself, but full of prospect and problems in its many forms, each of which exists within a context of someone's control. And it is that control, as Meyer Rothschild once said about controlling the issuance of money, that regardless of who makes the laws, controlling the issuance of money makes all the difference. Well, on this program, we espouse the democratic notion that money is a utility and should be a servant to the whole community, under the control of the people, in other words. Available to all to enable collaboration, investment, creation of new assets to satisfy needs and secure our common good. Money is a representative component of our common wealth. The reason we need to talk about it is that money has become so much more, a different kind of creature, more than a utilitarian functionary. Money is the most common of global deities. It's loved, worshipped, fought for, and zealously protected. It's got a kind of transcendent power expressed in the biblical admonition that the love of money is the root of all evil. So truly, today, as in previous eras, money has become the false idol of life in our modern world and is the primary reason for the existence of so much of our troubles, struggles, and the source of a sort of universal disorientation of human beings for whom existence itself is defined by whether they have any. Our culture is too much driven by an inseparable attachment to this essentially neutral, valueless symbol. But the parties who control our money hold the possibility of the future of our lives, our communities, states, the country, and in fact all of humankind. Now, you could ask yourself, if money is in the hands of the people instead of profiteers, would there be a real question about whether we can afford to shift our reliance from destructive, extractive fuels? Whether we'd be willing to allow starving masses to grow, others to be abandoned by a monetary system not designed to meet their most basic needs? Well, rather than go on with these ruminations, we've got a few related conversations to share with you today about current realities of our global monetary reality from Paul Hellyer, one of the most circumspect and authoritative civic observers, and Matt Standard, who will discuss money as an essential utility like water and electricity, which could easily be shared with all. And then we'll dive into how the private controllers of municipal money have led cities like Los Angeles and many others into disastrous and enormously expensive money deals with Wall Street banks, with our guest, Lisa Cody of the SEIU, who did a landmark study of the scandalous fees paid by the taxpayers of Los Angeles that forced that city to cut services to pay Wall Street. She'll be speaking on this week's segment of What Wall Street Costs America. But now let's talk with Ellen about some of the monetary issues that are emerging on the big bank regulatory front and how that situation is leaving us all exposed to potential economic collapse.
One thing that our banks are finding quite onerous, they haven't been able to meet the living will requirement. And if they can't meet it under the Dodd-Frank Act, then they can be broken up. In other words, if they're too big to fail and they can't demonstrate how they would prevent contagion, you know, like a bringing down the whole economy if they went bankrupt, then under Dodd-Frank, they can be broken up. I thought that was pretty interesting that after three tries, J.P. Morgan Chase has not been able to come up with a satisfactory living will. In fact, eight of the biggest banks have not been able to come up with satisfactory living wills, but particularly J.P. Morgan Chase and the Federal Reserve said their living will had holes in it that were such a threat that it was a threat to the financial stability of the U.S. I mean, not the financial stability of the bank or the depositors, but of the entire country. So why is it that they can't comply after all these attempts? It seems to me it's because J.P. Morgan Chase has more than $50 trillion in derivatives, and they only have $1.4 trillion in deposits. So no matter how you slice it, I mean, they can come up with all different models, but there's no way there's enough money to pay off all the claims. We know that derivatives claims go first, so they're going to jump in and grab all the collateral. In fact, as soon as there's any hint of trouble, they're going to jump in and grab all the collateral, and that will bring the whole thing down, which is what happened to Lehman Brothers. And therefore, there's not going to be anything left for the depositors and for state and local governments who think that they are secured. But the same security is used for the derivatives. They use it over and over. They rehypothecate it. It's just the way derivatives work. It's a sale and repurchase. So overnight, banks do these repos where supposedly they sell assets, which is the collateral. They sell the collateral and buy it back the next day. And that's how they manage to balance their books when they don't really have the money. I mean, that's the problem with the whole system, of course, is banks don't really have the money. And that's why they have to jump through all these hoops and do all these other sleight of hand to make it look like they have the money. Which, to me, is why we should have public banks. Because let's just acknowledge that banks create the money they lend on their books. Who do you want creating your money? Do you want private banks doing it and charging you a hefty fee? Or would you rather have public servants who have a mandate to serve the public? So they've attempted to impose rules to bail out all the banks. So the new bail-in rules that we first saw them in Cyprus, and then there were a bunch of bail-ins last year in 2015, like in Italy, and those went wrong. And then in Austria, they attempted to do bail-ins, and the investors objected. And then this spring, they finally did the ultimate bail-in where they said, sorry, we don't have any money. You know, okay, we guaranteed these debts. We just don't have the money, so we can't we can't pay. And that's the risk. You're relying on these insurance schemes. If the insurance scheme runs out of money, if the FDIC runs out of money, then either there's nobody to pay or the taxpayers are going to wind up paying it after all. So there's, it just seems to me there's no way that you can make this system safe because of the nature of the system. So let's just acknowledge that it's a public service and have it all be totally transparent and totally accountable.
It's such a shell game. I love that word, rehypothecate.
Because it's so vague. I know it sounds harmless, but when you realize what it means is you're selling something you don't have. It's a lot like short sales in stock. You borrow the thing and sell it into the market, and then you're supposed to buy it back. You're hoping you can buy it back cheaper, and then you keep the difference. Maybe you have to buy it back more expensive, but you have to buy it back anyway. But then the risk is that the whole thing will crash and they won't have the money to buy it back. In this way, they manage to manipulate prices. They can bring down the price of a stock when the real shareholders don't think it's worth less because of this market manipulation. So we're allowing all these private players to manipulate markets with very cheap credit that they're getting from the Federal Reserve, which is the head of their system.
And there's no there.
Yeah.
Because it's Yeah. Now, something else has happened this week, or seems to be emerging from what we see about Congress, the idea that some U.S. senators are okaying banking access for the marijuana business.
There's a bill pending, right?
A bill pending. It looks like it's got pretty good support. We're saying that, well, this is a great time for public banks to come into the picture as localities and states and cities could capture that money by keeping that tax money in their locales. They're able to use that for their local investment and for liquidity, as opposed to having the marijuana growers move their deposits into Bank of America or Wells or one of the big ones. Seems to me that'd be a great way to build the local interests.
Yeah, no, I agree. If we can offer them a cheap and effective service, but the reason people have approached us before about providing a bank for the marijuana money, but we couldn't for the same reasons the other banks couldn't, that it's
basically money laundering, right? It's an exciting development, and I guess once again, kind of come back to the view about how local economies, but even state-based economies, have an opportunity for a new footing to be able to build their own resources for loans that they can keep in-house if they manage to do it.
Well, one other thing I wanted to talk about, I gave a presentation on Saturday on why we should have public banks. Somebody wrote an article, an op-ed article, on the New Hampshire bill that's pending for a public bank and why we shouldn't have public banks. And so I just want to address one point that always comes up, and that to me it just shows that people aren't getting it. I mean, the problem we've always had with these bills is people really don't see the difference between a depository bank and a revolving fund. So one of the big arguments is always that, well, the state already has agencies that lend money into the community, and they're doing fine. Or if we can give them more money, or we can make a revolving fund where you lend money into the community, and we don't need a bank for that. But the difference is that a revolving fund, you lend the money out. Let's say you have $10 million, enough to start a bank. So you can lend your $10 million out at 3%, and you wait for it to come back. And then you can lend it again at 3%, and you wait for it to come back. If you have a depository bank, you get at least five times the bang for the buck. If you were to use that same money as the capital for your bank, now you will need $100 million in deposits, but you've got the deposits. You are a state or a city, you know, a municipality of some sort, a big county. So you've got lots of deposits that are currently sitting in Wall Street banks doing virtually nothing. You know, they're making money for the Wall Street banks. They're paying you almost nothing. So if you pull those deposits back, put them in your own bank, you've got now $100 million in deposits, hold back $10 million for the reserve requirement. You can now lend, instead of lending $10 million, you can now lend $90 million. So you can still make, by my figures, even if you're paying 7% on your capital, you can still make 15% return on equity. And we know that the Bank of North Dakota has been making 20%, and this is return on equity, which is substantially better than Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan Chase. And why can they, according to the Wall Street Journal? And they're still doing that. They've had the best returns ever, despite this huge oil bust. So it's not all about oil. Why are they able to do that? Because they have very low costs, cheaper costs than a commercial bank. But the point I want to get across is that you get much more leverage out of your money if you are able to do what all banks do, which is create money. Effectively, you're creating money on your book by turning your deposits into loans. And if you're talking about the risk of your public deposits, your Wall Street banks have gotten very risky for the reason that they're double counting their collateral. And even the Federal Reserve has said that they were not able to come up with credible living wills that would protect your deposits in the event of a collapse. So we have to almost set up our own banks.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think you're right. I think we are going to have our own banks. Well, Ellen, thanks once again, and we'll see what happens next.
Okay. It is my great pleasure to be speaking with the Honorable Paul Hellyer, one of Canada's best-known and longest-serving politicians. He was first elected to the Canadian House of Commons in 1949. So let's see, that would be 67 years ago, when he was the youngest member ever to have been elected there. He went on to serve as National Defense Minister, among other noteworthy posts. In 1997, he formed his own political party, the Canadian Action Party, which has been very active in the monetary reform movement. He is the author of 13 books, the latest of which is titled The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis. It's great to be talking with you again, Paul.
Likewise. Good to hear your voice. I read you faithfully, but haven't talked to you for quite a while.
Oh, thank you. So you've reached a venerable age where you actually deserve to rest on your laurels and enjoy your retirement, but you're still in the fray, writing excellent books aimed at fixing what has gone wrong in the system. We discussed your latest very interesting book, The Money Mafia, the last time we spoke, but what I wanted to talk about today was just sort of an update on what's going on in Canada. I know there are some interesting monetary reform developments there. One thing you've written a lot about is the Bank of Canada, which was a very productive credit engine for the country between 1939 and 1974, after which it abdicated its power to private bankers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was a great system in those days.
Right. Funded all sorts of infrastructure, funded Canada's participation in World War II, set up social services, including your excellent health service. I guess it's gone downhill since it doesn't have the funding it used to have, so lately it's not quite as good. What was interesting was that happened under the father of your current prime minister, so under Pierre Trudeau, and your new prime minister is Justin Trudeau, who everybody seems to like very much. He's young and dynamic and has great ideas. So you just wrote a letter to Justin Trudeau commending him on his spending priorities and suggesting that he consider returning to that method of funding development through the Bank of Canada at near zero interest rates rather than by borrowing from banks. And as a former minister, you might actually get his ear. So I wondered if you could expand on what you're proposing and what you think of your new prime minister and what the possibilities are there.
Yes, the open letter to the prime minister actually went on the wire and was well received. Michelle Chesedowski sent me a note yesterday. He published it too, and said it was getting a great reaction.
Oh, great!
The second thing that was in the letter, I commended him for his strong support of the necessity of federal government spending to get the economy going, and said that was the only trick that had ever worked, and of course went back and talked about what happened from 39 on and how the system reacted to the sharing of the money creation function between the federal government and the private banks. But then I said that there seemed to be, and this was in reference to his visit to the G7, there confusion about the method of payment. And that his option of borrowing the money was not the preferred solution. And, of course, explained in simple terms why when money is all created as debt and it has to be repaid with interest, and no one creates any money to repay either the principal or interest, mathematically the system is stupid. Well, let me pick a nicer word. Dumb, insane, or whatever,
yeah.
Take your choice of words, and there was a dead end, and that the only solution, if they want to save the present system, the only solution is a massive infusion of government-created debt-free money. And, you know, there's the alternative, of course, nationalization and so on, but if they want to make the present system work and to reduce the leverage of the banking system, so that it no longer has a monopoly on the creation of money, then they have to have a mechanism for government-created debt-free money. And what we, a small group of people up here who call ourselves the Canadian Bank Reformers, it's sort of an offshoot of Comer and the Canadian Action Party and so on. What we're suggesting is that as collateral for the Bank of Canada to issue money to the federal government, that we use non-convertible, non-redeemable shares in Canada. In other words, get away from bonds because they have to be tallied as debt, and just have the Government of Canada print some common shares and give those to the Bank of Canada as collateral for the creation of money. That will allow them to balance their books. And our specific recipe is to have them create $150 billion a year for 7 years and split it 50% between the federal government and the provinces and territories in proportion to their populations. And this would allow a rapid growth of the economy, and it would give the provinces the power they need to make quick decisions to do the things they want. And of course, because it's over 7 years, they would be able to start infrastructure projects and be able to complete them. They would know they'd be able to complete them and so on. During this period, the bank reserve requirements, we'd have to get away from the capital adequacy system that's crept in these last few decades and go back to the cash reserve system. And the cash reserves of the private banks would have to be increased at the rate of about 5% a year over the 7 years until they reach 34%. And at the end of 7 years, bank leverage would be reduced from 20 to 1 to 2 to 1, which was the leverage when the Bank of England was first chartered a little over 300 years ago. And this, in our opinion, would allow both sectors to operate in their own domain. In other words, the governments would have enough money to do the things that have to be done with reasonable tax levels and never have a deficit again. And at the same time, between now and the end of the 7 years, they would have surpluses that they could use to reduce some of their present indebtedness. In the Canadian case, I figure that if they wanted to, they could reduce the outstanding federal debt by about a third, which would give the government a lot more flexibility in its tax policies and so on, and reduce the proportion of people's earnings that had to be diverted to pay interest on the existing debt. So it's a well thought out program to transform the system from one where the central banks of the world, in other words, the rich elite, are running the world, to one where the banks would just be able to do the things they should do, which is to provide a little financing for startup companies and small companies and to individuals when they're in trouble and need a little financial assistance and so on, but not to operate the world as a great big casino, as is the case at the moment, and do nothing but siphon off earnings from the people to make the rich even richer. And so I sent this to the Prime Minister, and I'm going to follow up because I think you read an article that was just published in Comer about the possibility of an infrastructure bank in Canada. And this alarms me very much because what it means is that the government is going right down the line with the neoliberals and with the idea of letting people who created money out of thin air buy up our real assets. And we've had enough of that. We don't want any more, and especially the kind that's going on in the province of Ontario. For example, they've started to sell off our hydro distribution system. And so what they're doing is taking revenue-producing assets and selling them to private enterprise. And what they're then investing the money in are non-revenue-producing assets, so that the people are going further into debt and losing some of their income at the same time. And the whole system is being loaded to, I think you stated it very nicely at one time, that we're making us slaves of debt or slave bondage to the elite, and sort of a reincarnation of the feudal system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks to me like what's happening is that because banks have the power to create money, they're creating all of the money, virtually all of it, 97% according to the Bank of England, and lending it to us. And so there's never enough money, as you point out, to pay it all back. So there's always this huge debt overhang, which means that all governments are also in debt. And therefore, because they never have enough tax money to pay for all the things they need, they have to borrow. And so therefore, they're coerced into selling off their public assets to pay off these debts.
Of course.
And that's the whole idea. You have this big money out there that wants to buy up everything and rent it back to us. They want to own it all, rent it back to us. So it's sort of in an old feudal system where we have to rent our own public assets in order to use them. And how do they get away with that? It's because of this whole system where they create the money. So the big objection you get from politicians, I think the reason they don't pay attention to these ideas of letting the government print the money, is everybody thinks it would be inflationary. But that's what we need. We need more money out there. We need enough money to pay the bills without having to borrow it into existence, which invariably means a debt at more interest.
Yes,
so I'm totally behind your proposals here. The big issue is how we get it out there in a way that people get it, and particularly politicians get it.
It doesn't need to be inflationary, because we're increasing the cash reserve requirements of the banks at the exact same rate that we're putting money into circulation.
Mm-hmm. And explain that a little more?
Sure. At the present time in Canada, for example, there are no cash reserve requirements. Banks don't have any need to have cash in their vaults except for the convenience of their customers. So you're lucky if your bank has maybe a cent or a cent and a half in legal tender for every dollar you think you have in the bank. They had no money to lend in the first place. They created the money that they lent you, but then they have no cash to stand behind it because they don't need to keep cash, and they don't. And what we're saying is that if, under our system, we would go back to the system, which was in effect for a long time, that it was actually a partial reserve system where there had to be a reserve. But now, mm-hmm. there's no cash reserve. It's just capital adequacy, and I've often said that should be called capital inadequacy, because it's just
right.
a term, and there's not enough capital there to last more than a few days if the system crashes again. Mm-hmm. So there's really what they're trying to do is to coerce the countries of the world into becoming vassals to do as they're told. And it's part of a larger scheme, I think. They call it the New World Order. And they want to create an unelected world government of, by, and for their own benefits. And unless we do something, that is going to happen. It's in the process of happening. It's been going on for 60 or 70 years now. And we have done nothing about it because most people don't understand what money is or where it comes from.
Right.
And we just put out a little pamphlet, a little flyer, explaining some of these things, but then how do you get them distributed? How do you influence enough people to create a public wave of interest and determination to force governments to take some action? That's extremely difficult. I spoke in Rochester, New York, and when we got on the subject, and when I said that what you would have to do to the Fed was expropriate it, and I got a big round of applause for that. And I thought, well, there is some understanding in some quarters of how they have taken the American people to the cleaners for 103 years, and how this quantitative easing that has been going on was used primarily to buy up real assets, instead of going into the hands of the public to solve their needs and to provide employment. So the present system is so, I don't know, I have to watch my language, so loaded against the people and in favor of the rich elite that it's almost difficult to describe.
But you can see, I mean, I totally agree with you that this is intentional and there is a cabal of some sort behind it. But you can see where it also goes that, you know, it's sort of an unconscious machine that also goes that way. For example, I was reading the pension funds, the big private pension funds. These are private investors, but we're sympathetic because, after all, that's our money, more or less. You know, some of our people are working there. And they're looking for good investments. But what they want is something that'll give them a nice return. You know, they're all looking at numbers, and they don't really even want to buy brand new, invest in like brand new infrastructure. They don't want to build the infrastructure because that's too risky. They want to buy the stuff that's already built. So they want to buy it off the governments, and they consider that a good investment. So there's no conscious intent to gouge the governments necessarily. It's just that the governments wind up putting these things up for sale, and the big money, which is like big pension funds and big BlackRock, apparently is hooked into this Canada Infrastructure Bank. They're big advisors on it. BlackRock is the biggest investment management corporation in the world. So they're directing big money into public-private partnerships. Go ahead.
What's going on is that there was a case I read today, I guess it was in that article by Joyce Nielsen, where Alberta or British Columbia had sold to the private enterprise, to Warren Buffett, I think it was, for $3 billion, what the taxpayers had paid $14 or $15 billion to build. So They want to buy it at discounts, and they don't want to take risks. And if the economy is going to adapt and to grow, and if it's going to adapt for clean energy and in time to save the globe from going up in flames, for example, they're going to have to take some risks and start some new ventures. But if you've got all the capital just saying, well, we don't need to take any risks, we can steal this stuff from the governments under pressure that they have to raise money to pay the interest on their debt, and they have no way to get it except to sell these assets, so we'll get them to fire sale. And that's what's been going on, and that's the way they've been robbing the poor countries for the last 20 years, 20 or 30.
Right, they can get away with it because the governments have no alternative. They need
the
money, and they'll sell it for whatever the market will bear.
But that's
the thing. That's why you need some government regulation here. You need the government to step in, issue its own money, obviously, or borrow from its own central bank, which issues the money, and then it has an alternative. So that's basically what public banking is all about another source of revenue for governments and people.
Well, it's a big subject, and all I can say is I'm pessimistic about what our government is doing, because it looks as if they're going to start an infrastructure bank, which just means that foreign capital or pension funds can buy assets, and the people have to first of all, pay them rent on it for years and years, maybe in perpetuity, and there's no revenue production.
Right,
so,
it's the parasite model that Michael Hudson's been writing about. They're just extracting wealth out of the system without putting anything good into it. But we need them because we don't have any other source of revenue. But we could by redesigning the system into what it should have been and was to start with until it got usurped by
the governments have to intervene in a way that they have not in the last 30 or 40 years. I think you know that in Canada, for example, we accumulated $615 billion in debt after the Bank of Canada stopped funding the federal government. And you were the first one to point out to me, and I hate to admit it, but I didn't totally believe you the first time you mentioned it. But I have to be honest. And you said we'd paid over $1 trillion in interest. And between 1974-75 fiscal year and 2010 and 2011 fiscal year, we paid $1 trillion on the debt that we had to borrow that should have been provided by the Bank of Canada, and we still have the debt. We're not out from under it yet. It's hanging over our head. And the present government is planning to increase it by $100 billion in 4 years. So it'll be worse rather than better. And, of course,
So you can see that that's what's gone on in third world countries, where it's quite obvious what happened, where our American companies have gone in and I guess the IMF has gone in, or the World Bank, and persuaded them they needed these different projects that they didn't really need. So they get built by American companies who get the money, and then they're indefinitely in debt thereafter, and they can't really pay that off. But now that's happening to us, where they're coming in and building our infrastructure and taking the proceeds and putting us in debt.
After they've got all the poor countries' assets, who's left?
Right. I wondered if you could also give us an update on the the lawsuit by Comer, the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform, against the Bank of Canada attempting to get them to return to what they were doing before 1974?
Yeah, the decision came down earlier this year where the presiding judge reversed both himself and the Court of Appeal that had upheld an earlier decision on his part. It is the most interesting and, and the strangest decision that we have ever seen. And, of course, Rocco Galati, who has been running this case for us, says it's illegal. But nevertheless, he has appealed that back to the Court of Appeal, and that will be held someday. And then if he loses there, they're committed to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada. And
wow, that's great. I'm glad they're still pushing.
If they go to the Supreme Court of Canada, I think they would probably win. But that could be just far enough ahead that a lot of people would suffer in this 10-year recession we've had, with people not having any future and not having jobs and not having career prospects, would still be going on, and longer than the Great Depression.
Right. Well, we do see signs of revolution or change, political change, and hopefully it seems to me that our job is to just get the information out there so people get it, that there's another way to do it, that it won't be inflationary to allow the government to print money, that they've actually stolen that power from us, and that's where the problem is. The problem is that we're not printing our money.
That's right. We haven't been using something that we own. We've been giving it away. Pay, and then paying to have them, I was going to say rob us, but I
close enough.
Something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. It's great to get your updates and to be talking to you. I wondered if you had any more you wanted to comment on?
I guess the main thing is vigilance, and I would urge the American people to pay more attention to people like Michael Hudson and others, the dissenters, the people who say that what's been happening to us in the last few decades is one gigantic con game, that we're being taken and that there's an ulterior motive. You should find out what it is before it's too late, and you wake up one morning and find out it's too late. And you mentioned my latest book. My latest two books actually are good to read on this subject, Light at the End of the Tunnel, The Survival Plan for the Human Species, and then The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis, which I think is unique in that it not only sets out the problems of the world, the principal problems, the monetary policy of the global warming and the extraterrestrial presence and technology, but actually lists the things that have to be done for the American people to recapture their country and put it back under the Constitution. So that's the kind of thing that I would urge them to do. Is knowledge is power, and if more people would take time out to read books, then I think they would be able to have a stronger stand in protecting their own interests.
Mm-hmm. I love the fact that you ventured into the extraterrestrial subject. I agree with you on that, but, you know, it's so hard to bring it up.
People aren't yet exposed to it, and the governments have lied to them for 70 years about it now.
Right. I think that's the trouble in general, is that the media lies and people, busy people, have their jobs and their kids, and they turn on 10 minutes of news and think they know what's going on in the world. So that's the first thing we have to change, is the media and the information system, the education system.
I don't know how you do that, because in a new book by Daniel Estulin I just finished reading, it was very depressing in some respects, he lists the conglomerates that control all of the English language major news outlets in the world, and they're all controlled by Bilderbergers.
Wow.
In other words, part of the group that's been running the world for the last half century and still is.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's an uphill battle, but it seems to me that the more people wake up, the harder of a job they will have pulling it off.
We'll have to share the knowledge and hope that people will be receptive and want to do something about it.
Right, and you're a great inspiration for how you've kept out there pushing the envelope.
Well, I'm doing the best I can. I'll soon be 93.
Wow, that's very impressive. You're
still working 5.5 days
a week.
Sharp
as a tack.
Well, I've been blessed, and I know that I have good health. Touch wood, touching my head. But I will keep going as long as I can because the stakes are so high. The stakes really of the future of the human species.
Oh, that's wonderful. Do you have websites or anything you want to point us to? Of course, we want to emphasize your books, Light at the End of the Tunnel.
I have a website, which is paulhalyerweb.com. And then there's the new website of the group that I mentioned, which is Canadian Bank Reformers, all one word, .ca. www.canadianbankreformers.ca. And some people down there might want to sort of follow what we're doing in the months ahead and see if they can get any information from it that might be useful.
Okay, well, that sounds great. Thank you again.
Well, thanks for calling, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Likewise. Okay.
Bye for now.
Okay, bye. I've been speaking with Paul Hellyer, former Canadian finance minister and the author of 13 books, the latest of which is The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis.
I'm Matt Stannard. What is money? If you're one of our listeners, you know that's a deep question. But it's about to be asked more and more in the context of whether the governments of the world ought to create it for their people. During the first week of June, voters in Switzerland had the opportunity to vote for a proposal that would have given each adult in the country about $2,500 a month, and each child a little less than half of that. It was the first referendum anywhere on the question of a universal basic income. As it turned out, the specific proposal lost badly. 77% of voters opposed it. The outcome wasn't surprising. No Swiss politicians supported it. Many widely criticized it, alleging it would sever the link between work and money. Fair enough. That link is arbitrary, and that argument ignores a lot about how money is made. But that mainstream view is hardly surprising. What may surprise people about the Swiss referendum, though, is not the vote, but the beliefs and attitudes of the voters. They might have rejected basic income as a specific policy, but they affirmed it as a concept, as an inevitability, and as a component of a just society. Even those who voted against it. If you find that hard to believe, listen to this data. Those who voted overwhelmingly believed the issue would be revisited soon. 72% of the total voters believed basic income would soon be necessary due to job losses from automation. 70% of those who voted no believed the measure would come up again in several decades. Voters also supported testing basic income in local municipalities. And in a survey conducted before the referendum, among members of the European Union as a whole, 64% supported basic income. So regardless of the Swiss referendum, why is the idea of guaranteed minimum income both inevitable and desirable? Well, first and foundationally, because economic insecurity is killing us. In the U.S. alone, over 60% of Americans can't afford a $500 emergency. Continuous and unrelenting insecurity kills. People are dying. They're dying earlier. People are becoming mentally unstable, overwhelmed, demoralized, and sick. Similar deprivation exists all over the world, and although parts of Europe seem to be enjoying more security than the rest of the world, that's contingent on the existence of productive institutionalized work, and that is about to change. Which brings us to reason number two. The nature of work is going to drastically change. The impact of automation on employment has become anecdotally treated in the media, but it's not just media speculation. Two scholars from MIT's Sloan School of Management have documented how we're past the threshold where technological advances create jobs. Now, most every advance will cost jobs, and this at a time when we're increasingly aware that workers need to be paid more. So the system is unsustainable. If we don't consider simply meeting people's basic needs, then we're going to go on expecting, moralizing, and shaming people to work when there will simply not be enough conventional jobs. And if that's our approach, well, I hope you like hearing angry people sing the Internationale. The third reason we need basic income is that there's a lot of unpaid labor out there. Plenty of work, no jobs. A minimum income recognizes this. Understanding, supporting, and affirming interpersonal care, creative work, community service, and all the other keys to consciousness and cohesion would be a great antidote to that insecurity and alienation that we have discussed. And the final reason justifying minimum income is one that should readily be understood in the public banking movement. Money is a construct. Resources, I mean natural resources, are sure scarce. They're finite. But money is as scarce or available as we choose to make it. This is important. Although many material resources are scarce, money is a social construct. That doesn't mean we ought to create money carelessly, but it does mean we can finally make money available as we see fit in the public interest. And so, the British Labour Party is considering both basic income and quantitative easing for the people as policies. In Oakland, California, a basic income experiment is underway. A similar experiment will take place in Finland in 2017, and more people all over the world are talking about basic income than ever before. People on the right, people on the left, people concerned with social citizenship, and people concerned with individual autonomy and collective security. What emerges will be a radical redefinition of our money. This is Matt Stannard.
Time now for a new edition of What Wall Street Costs America. On this week's edition of What Wall Street Costs America, we look into the outrageously profitable realm of managing municipal finance dollars for the Wall Street banksters. We talk with the researcher behind a landmark study called No Small Fees that exposed the hundreds of millions of tax dollars paid to Wall Street fund managers by the City of Los Angeles every year to manage various city funds. Lisa Cote is a researcher with the Service Employees International Union Local 721 in Los Angeles. The SEIU teamed up with numerous other area stakeholders to create the report.
What precipitated it was looking at the fact that the City of Los Angeles, in any one year, we anticipated was spending an exorbitant amount of fees on just paying for regular issuing debt, paying for merchant accounts, paying for investment banking fees. And we were interested in looking at how much the city was willing to pay Wall Street, while at the same time we're slashing our workforce down by 10% throughout the recession, slashing city services to either coming to a halt or slashing them so severely that it was basically the same as not having those services. You know, they stopped trimming trees, they stopped fixing streets, they stopped cleaning catch basins, to such a degree that we were at risk for flooding, people are at risk when they were driving on the streets or walking on the sidewalks. So we were concerned that LA's priorities were somewhat askew in our opinion, that while every department had to go in front of a budget committee and decide and be criticized or decide how much they had to cut or how much they were allowed to spend, basically the Wall Street bankers sat on the other side and had nothing, had never had to take a haircut, never had to take a reduction. And so that was sort of the impetus. And the Fix LA Coalition was born out of the idea that we're going to continue to fight this battle, and the Fix LA Coalition has continued on. And we actually achieved a number of goals that are common good goals out of bargaining that had nothing to do with specifically with our members, like a jobs committee and a revenue commission, which are both aimed at bringing 5,000 jobs back to the City of Los Angeles.
Right.
That's outside of our bargaining agreement.
Were you able to cut some of the fees to compensate?
Well, actually, we've tried to do that. They have cut some of their merchant accounts. We're still working on them, you know, understanding how much they're getting sort of taken on their investments within our pension funds. That's difficult to do because a lot of the fees that come out of investments for pension funds are hidden fees. They're performance fees. They come off the top. That means they come off before you receive your return. So your return might be 12 or 13%, but what you see is 9. And they actually are not allowed by law to see those performance fees. They're exempt from Public Records Act. They sign agreements saying they will not ask for them.
Why? Why do they sign agreements for public money not being...
Because they figure they won't get access to the best financial investment bankers out there if they don't.
I see. So that the $3 trillion municipal bond market has no leverage against these people. Is that
one would think it doesn't. I mean, that's what's amazing. We find, you know, LA is, what, the second largest city in the country, but yet most of the people that operate sort of staff investment advisors at a pension fund, or whether the finance people in the debt departments of the city, they all feel completely, it seems, kowtowed to Wall Street. They all feel that either if they're a debt person or a bond person, that they're going to have their ratings are going to be taken away from them. They're going to be downgraded by the rating agencies if they do anything to sort of upset the bankers. And the other people feel like they won't have access to the best there is to offer at Wall Street. As one ex sort of financial person you said was, you know, the banks would do business with the devil. Like it wouldn't, no matter what you do, someone's going to step in and take place right. Someone who refuses. So that's sort of a false argument, I think, but I know that that's what they've told us
right.
In private. It's the reason they fear sort of stepping outside of that box and making that demand.
And so in order for the city to come up with the $204 million in fees and payments, that's not interest, right? That's
actually, no. There's actually a more updated report, and it's $334 million, and that's an estimate. That's a conservative estimate. We found that even the investment management fees that we thought were all reported are actually not. They're actually, unless they're invoiced, they're not reported, directly invoiced with a piece of paper. We found at least for one pension fund, they were willing to report what they didn't get invoiced in their budget. So we found, I think, 34 or 40 more million dollars of investment management fees that aren't required to be reported in the CAFR, which is the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. So those aren't required by the rules of municipal finance because they're not directly invoiced. So any of the pension funds or actually anybody, as long as they don't receive a direct physical invoice, they don't actually have to report them in their annual public financial statement. So actually, we didn't even report what probably the other two pension funds for the city, they probably also have non-invoiced investment management fees, but they don't report them anywhere. So they don't report them in their budget or anywhere else. So that's why I say it's conservative, because that number went from 133 to 177.1 for investment management fees.
Well, now, so when you have a manager of a fund, they're getting typically, what, 2% of the gross and then 20% of the profits?
2% of the fees under management. Yeah, so yes, generally 20% of the profits. And there are all sorts of hidden fees in there where, for example, like a private equity investment, you might be paying as an investor, or the pension fund, which is an investor, you might be paying something you're not aware of. Like you might be paying for a manager to manage that company that you just bought out in private equity, and you're not really aware of that. That's coming off the top. So you're not just paying for the fee of the manager who's managing that account or that fund. You might be paying for, like I said, a hired person who's taking care and managing the company under that they've got, that they just bought. You might be paying other fees within that structure that you're not aware of. And then the performance fees, yeah, they can be 20%, they could be more, but you really, all those pension funds know is they get 9%. That's all they know. They say, well, we get 9%. That's what we want. Well, what did you really get? You can't compare that, because basically you don't know what you're losing off the top. You're actually getting 14%, and you're losing 5 of it to the manager or to other fees. It's hard for, you can't compare them. And that's, they just don't seem to understand that. They just say, well, we get 9%. Well, you didn't, you actually got more.
Wow.
So we have a whole division in SEIU International. It's called Capital Stewardship, which has been working for years on getting these pension funds to understand what they're doing and the problem that can occur with hedge funds or private equity or other investments, like where basically it's a complete mystery how much money is actually being taken from these hedge funds for these investments. I mean, in our opinion, we suggested this long ago that they should spend the money instead on very well-trained, highly respected investment bankers and pay them what they ask for, and instead not pay them any performance fees. But the problem is, if you can't convince the board of trustees to do that, if you can't tell them how much they're losing. Well, if they knew that they were losing $80 million every year in performance fees, that $1 million they're spending on a high-level Wall Street banker might not seem so much money.
So one of your solutions is to bring that management in-house.
Yeah, That is one that we pushed very early on. There's a small group in Canada that's done this for years. And of course, they started very small and now they're very big. But yeah. But they basically started by hiring high-level people and not paying them performance fees and paying them a high salary and getting them to basically be that high-level investment manager. And now they're probably one of the most successful pension funds in the world.
Wow.
There are people out there, experts, municipal experts, academics, who said that the municipalities, states, local governments, you know, they borrow money to finance their schools, the roads, the public buildings, water and electrical infrastructure, but they're paying far more, they say, than what private sector pays for the same product. And so that's sort of the issue here is pay. There's always a fee associated with paying, and it's not just interest and principal. But the degree that municipalities are paying those fees in comparison to private sector investors is much higher. And any municipality who says that that's not true doesn't know the truth. Well, you're all getting
right.
You're all getting rolled over. It's all of them are getting taken for too much money. And I mean, when you pay more in fees than you pay for your city streets to be worked on, that's insane for a city as large as Los Angeles. And the majority of that is investment management fees, no doubt, and performance fees from the pension funds. But that's not to say that there aren't other fees going on in, you know, there's issuance costs, there's letters of credit costs, there's securities lending fees for different investments the city has, there's legal counsel fees, remarketing fees.
So what we're seeing here and what you've done brilliantly is characterize and inventory what Wall Street has cost Los Angeles just in this particular way, continues to. It's now, you know, built into the infrastructure of the finance of the city.
It
would seem like they're locked in. So yeah, I want to thank you very much for describing some of that to us, and I know that LA is not alone. It's in good but troubled company. Chicago and Philadelphia and
Detroit. Some of the cities. I mean, I think the state of Illinois will end up paying more than $800 million in fees and their swaps.
Wow.
By the time they're done, almost $1 billion.
And we have to remember that these fees, we're not paying back principal. We're not paying back money that we got from them. We're paying them a deal. This is a bet. This is a speculation.
Exactly.
This is an arrangement that through their own particular relationships with the powers that be, they'd be able to get a nice fat payday at public expense. Well, Lisa Cody of the SEIU in Los Angeles, we really look forward to your participating with this project. And thank you so much for elucidating this business about what Wall Street has cost Los Angeles and giving us all a whiff of what it's costing America.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
That's Lisa Cody of the SEIU Local 721, author of No Small Fees. You'll find other stories about Wall Street impacts on America at our website, whatwallstreetcosts.org, and ways that you can participate in creating an important new national conversation showing how public interest is being undermined by the Wall Street banks.
On Wall Street.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.